Hello, everyone. It's great to be here today. Rebecca Fifield and I are going to be focusing on disaster preparedness and response. I'm the CEO of the Conservation Center in Chicago, and where I want to begin here is talking from experiences of previous disasters and the lessons learned from them, and how we can all begin to adapt to these very difficult and challenging situations when these disasters do occur. Before I get started on all of this, I'd like, if you mind raising your hand, if any of you have been through a disaster with your institution. Okay. So some of you have had this kind of exposure to how daunting and humbling this kind of thing can be, whether it is a pipe burst or a fire or a hurricane or a flood or even a crime scene or an explosion. So many variables can come into play. I am going to be referencing these seven different scenarios listed here, and I'm going to refer back to them as case studies and decisions that were made right after the loss occurred, and how that decision-making process created better outcomes in the final results of the claim itself. So all of this begins with a really good disaster plan, and all of this has to be thought out and done in the beginning stages. And of course, this is very time consuming. There are a lot of facts and details related to the geography and the building and the security and the potential exposures to your specific institution, and really going into the facets and the details of everything related to your institution and laying that out in the disaster plan. Obviously, I don't have the time to dive into that. What I really want to focus on today is the human exposure and experience that we go through in dealing with things like this, and how we have to really think in a very adaptive manner. So I want to start with the human resources and training side of a disaster plan. These are typical things that are involved in that planning process. The one I want to highlight here and refer back to the University of Iowa Museum was the evacuation protocol. Sometimes when disasters are about to arrive, we have notice of them, whether it's a flood or a hurricane, and obviously using those plans that are in place to make healthy decisions before the disaster has officially landed right in front of your institution. So the University of Iowa Museum is a great example of having an evacuation protocol and a priority plan on what needed to be removed from the building prior, and of course being as efficient and as effective under pressure to remove all of those items from the first floor and storage facilities and get them out of harm's way. And obviously the final outcome in doing so was tremendously positive versus if people had waited and not followed through on that evacuation plan prior to the loss arriving, the results would have been immeasurably different, obviously. I also want to comment on the whole insurance side of all of this. Until we have been exposed to a disaster situation, I don't think any of us realize how pivotal the insurance elements of what we're dealing with it are. Whether it's the underwriting of the policy, understanding what the exclusions are, understanding what the roles of the different parties within the insurance industry is very helpful. Whether it's the broker or the adjuster, and obviously the broker is your advocate, and the adjuster is the person who follows and monitors everything that is going on in the recovery and the claim process. So understanding how they can have an impact in addition to not only your role and the staff role within your institution on a broad level, but also all the other parties that are going to be playing different roles in the process, and I'm going to be touching upon that. But before I move into those outside factors, I want to talk about the inside factors that you can be impactful with. And that is all in training and getting all of us to think differently about what it is like to be faced with a disaster scenario that can be incredibly depressing, it can be difficult, it can be stressful, It could create a very unhealthy environment where safety measures are obviously very important, as well as security. So I want to really try to focus on what we all go through and how we overcome those situations and stay focused, remain resilient. Making healthy decisions very quickly under pressure is probably the thing that I think is most problematic, and that comes down to all of us learning how to be adaptive in those very trying situations. So doing those training drills based on different types of scenarios is incredibly constructive on the preparative side so that when something actually does occur. So the next element, which is important, is having everyone on the inside of the institution trained and aware of what is necessary, but also what are those relationships that you are going to be relying on outside of the institution. So referring back to your broker and knowing that that broker was the person who was part of the underwriting process, understands the nuances and needs and obviously the biggest risk exposures with your risk management division under and related to the policy itself, but also understanding the role of the adjuster, and that sometimes that role can become difficult. It can become political, and it can sometimes even become adversarial as the process proceeds. So I would encourage original and right out of the gate communication levels being very high with all of those parties involved, because they're going to be following throughout those processes, and you want to have healthy relationships with those people because they are going to be making a lot of the big decisions along with your institution. Obviously, we have a lot of art shippers here involved in this conference because they play such an important role for all of us. We have to rely on them for their expertise and their technical acumen, and I encourage all of us to have relationships with them prior to a disaster ever happening. Know who you like working with, know who you trust, fostering those relationships with those parties, and even sometimes setting up those VIP relationships with them so that you're at the top of the list of service providing when those disasters do strike, because sometimes an entire city or community or even part of the nation can be affected all at once, and those resources really evaporate. And I want to reflect back to Katrina as well as Sandy when it relates to art shippers and conservators. Obviously, these disciplines appear very large to us across the nation, but when all of a sudden there's a tremendous amount of resources needed all at once and everybody is in need of them, that assistance dries up very quickly, and those resources obviously are very important. So if they are too busy and have other commitments, then you end up waiting for that kind of assistance and expertise, and that makes your situation even challenging, even more challenging to get positive results. So those relationships with art shippers and conservators, and lastly, I want to mention the building remediation companies. A lot of us don't want to think about those service providers. It's not part of our normal day-to-day activity, but they are instrumental in the building and the recovery of the building, and they also make a lot of big sky view decisions that will be impacting the art collections. And I want to refer to one example where there was a large collection with over 4,000 photographs, and there was a fire, and there was a tremendous amount of water used to put out the fire. Water usually follows fire. And the remediation company, whether it's a Paul Davis or a DKI or a Belfour, they come in and their role is to secure the building and do what's best for the building. Well, they were setting up a rapid dry procedure the next morning before the collection managers and the registrars and everyone was even able to get into the building. Luckily, this was imparted to other parties and it trickled down, and the people that understood the care and needs for the art collection notified those parties that were making those decisions and put it to a halt. And obviously then the artwork was removed from the building prior to that kind of extreme condition and humidity temperature controls were done. So those are just a few examples of where having those rapports and relationships with all of those other parties is very pivotal. The other element with many of these restoration and remediation companies is you can establish retainer services with them in advance experience. So once again, you are at the top of their list when something occurs, and you are not waiting for their assistance. And we noticed during Hurricane Sandy that that was a commonality. A lot of these restoration companies, building restorers, were completely avalanched, and many people had to literally wait for those service providers. So the next is the off-site backup and the importance of this. And you as registrars and people who manage this part of the collections, I cannot emphasize enough how important having this information updated, the thoroughness of it, and obviously that is what you dedicate a tremendous amount of your concentration and effort on, and it is a pivotal element of the recovery process. So making sure that those are saved off-site and all of that information is updated, and you're actually checking the off-site capabilities and making sure they're actually working. Also having the priority removal plan off-site and backed up so that you can also get access to that to make healthy decisions. And as far as once you do have access, what should those priorities be? Where should the focus be? And then what are maybe the secondary and tertiary elements that are dealt with after the immediate concerns? And then also having the documentation and appraisals and photography all off-site as well and updated because when the loss occurs, this is detrimental to the conservators and the people assisting with the condition issues and the treatment requirements, but also it is a huge element related to the claim process and adjusting process itself. So now I want to shift into what happens after the disaster has occurred and spend a little bit of time on on-site steps. Timely response is so instrumental here. I'll give an example where there was a pipe burst related to the ice storms last year, and one institution had water bugs connected to their alarm system, and they were notified over the weekend, and obviously everyone was able to create a team plan and get in on site and be extremely effective versus another institution that did not have those measures in place as part of their disaster plan. They come in on Monday morning and find a very unfortunate situation, and things have already accelerated considerably. The other element is really the team being confirmed as well, because when an entire community, city, or even part of a country have been affected, and you're relying on your team members and the team groups that you've established in your disaster plan, some of those people might have personal situations that have been affected, whether it's their home or their family, or some sort of health issue that has arisen because of the disaster being so broad. So some of those key team members might not even be available to assist in the recovery process. And what are your contingency plans if that were to happen? The third here I'm mentioning is access. This can be one of the most frustrating parts of the recovery process. I cannot mention how many times after the thousand plus disaster sites I've been on, large and small, this is the part that is extremely frustrating to the people who care and have put years of dedication into the collections when they have to literally wait for 3 days because of the fire marshal or the water extraction taking place and it taking longer than everyone planned. Try to use that time to plan and make additional decisions that are healthy and try not to get frustrated by that. And what that also does, it creates an anxiety once you do get on site in a pressure, a time pressure, and that really builds up emotionally to all of us. So going back to the element of the human response to most of this is where I want you to really focus your energy on that preparative side. Then another element that gets overlooked over time and time again is the safety and health concerns. Numerous times after Hurricane Sandy, we were telling people that is dangerous, you should not be doing that, you should be wearing respirators and you should be wearing goggles and you should be wearing Tyvek suits, the mold here is extreme. And people, because they're so excited in trying to recover the situation and how daunting it is, a lot of times under that pressure we forget about our own personal health and safety. And the secondary level is the safety of the collections themselves. So that is something that oftentimes gets overlooked under those conditions. So next is the walking through and making healthy scope decisions. And if I were to focus on one area that has the biggest impact on what the trajectory of the entire recovery of the situation is, it is making healthy scope decisions once you get in and do a walkthrough. So for example, with a fire scenario, you want to go to the core of the fire, see the parts of the collection that have been affected the most, make your decisions based on those items and those priorities, and then literally work your way out. Another example, making scope decisions, is thinking outside the box and sometimes doing things that may not seem typical museum standards, but they end up bridging and resolving things in a positive way. And one example of that is the floods in Iowa from 2008. An institution that had over 14 feet of water on the first floor rushed through the building. By the time they got that extreme amount of water out of the building, what was left was a collection on the first floor, brushed up like a wave on a wall in a pile of mud and debris. And going in and picking up those items, and the director and the registrars and the collection management looking and saying, "We can't even tell what these items are. This is so devastating." They literally thought everything on the first floor was an entire loss. But everyone put their heads together, thought a little creatively, and came up with an approach where we set up triage stations out on the front lawn of the institution. We had six sinks with the conservators and the managers of the collection, the people who were most knowledgeable about every item, and they made decisions together, going from one stage of the process to the next. Things were then dried and then packed and transported by professionals, and we ended up saving almost 80% of the pieces in that collection on the first floor, when initially that immediate scope response is nothing can be done. Well, we all, I think, know that once you're put under adverse circumstances, humans are pretty exceptional people, and we do great things, and we can come together to make those kind of decisions to have a tremendous impact. Documentation and inventory is also very important at this stage. You want to document everything in situ, because that documentation is going to become part of the adjusting and claim process. Also with the inventory, I highly can comment on the fact that everyone is rushing in. There are people managing the recovery of the building. There's all of these other people involved, parties coming and going. Security is obviously a very important issue at that point. So dealing with the inventory, making sure things are checked off before they're leaving the building, and that inventory is being monitored by key people that are the most knowledgeable about the collection, and mistakes are not being made, because then you move to the next phases of condition and conservation and treatment and insurance decisions, and all of that relies upon the inventory. So the next two things come hand in hand together, and that is related to stabilization and triage. And there's two tracks. Either you can do stabilization and triage on site, and you can make clean rooms and do that, but if you're dealing with a broad-based exposure where the entire institution has been affected, you are going to have to do that stabilization and triage at an alternative location, whether it be an art storage warehouse, a conservation laboratory, or a third-party building for that matter. But obviously, the temperature and humidity controls and monitoring that and modifying that slowly over time so that it is not shocking the collection is an important element, and obviously the medium sensitivities. In addition to the removal and deciding about the stabilization and triage is deciding which triage techniques are the most helpful based on the mediums in the collection and the effects that have occurred. Whether it's facing paintings and murals or removing pieces from frames, I can attest to the fact that doing the triage right then and there, if there's any potential of doing it, it has created much better outcomes in the long run. So for example, with a collection which was exposed to heavy flooding, 250 pieces were soaking wet in their frames. They were immediately transported off-site. There was a station of people in a certain order, taking them from one step to the next, and triaging them over the next 48 hours with rotating crews. And the results were astonishing versus freezing them or postponing those methods. The results were obviously not as positive. The transport at this point is also very important, is thinking about the professionals and doing this right and carefully, because if the transport is not done well, the conditions can be accelerating during this process and causing even worse results. And obviously relying on the conservators to do the examination and testing to then move into the slower stages of the recovery process when it comes to long-term treatment care and recovery of the collection over a very careful, measured, and consistent period. So here's just one example of something that is on the preventative side. We don't have enough time to talk about prevention, but this is a case scenario that I want to highlight where a collection of frame material was exposed to extreme soot. But because the curators and registrars and collection managers understood the importance of museum framing, all of those framing packages were taped and sealed on the inside of the framing package as well as the outside. So when this exposure happened, it minimized the damages considerably. So as I finish up here and turn over to Rebecca, I want to highlight some of the points I've just briefly covered. And the planning side of thing is so important, but more important than just establishing the disaster plan, updating it, training with it, making sure the offsite material is active and efficient as far as all the information you're going to need to have access to. I can't emphasize enough trying to get you and the rest of your team into that mental space of what it's going to be like to be walking into your institution after a major disaster, and how do you stay focused and be resourceful and calm with your decision making. And it has proven time and time again that when we all rally around things that we care about so much, we've spent our entire careers caring for these collections, and when you're confronted with this insurmountable situation, knowing that all of these parties can be playing their role to make healthy and effective decisions to recover the collection, and that is when great things happen. So I would like to turn it over to Rebecca.
Good morning. When Heather and I were approached to join forces on this session, it was a natural assumption that because I was talking about preparedness that I would go first. However, I think we all know that disasters or emergencies happen whether we're prepared or not. And that often we don't focus on disaster preparedness until we have to deal with recovery and we realize the value of being better prepared and ready for that moment. So as collections management professionals, we have a professional obligation to plan, to include contingency planning among our regular activities for our collections, for our organization, and for the public. Marie Malaro outlined in a legal primer for managing museum collections that competent collection stewardship includes planning for suboptimal operating conditions. The overall benefit to planning is developing rigor within an institutional system so when they're stretched by chaos, they remain flexible and we can get the work done. But often, we struggle to start. We struggle to just get going on the emergency planning. I think many of us have an experience where maybe a plan was written, but it got misplaced. A plan is somewhere. Someone worked on that at some point. We didn't share it with new staff. We wrote it, but we didn't train it. And my talk is based on my experiences in gaining buy-in among a variety of colleagues to commit not only to writing an emergency plan, but making it an ongoing emergency management program. We might have had different backgrounds and different responsibilities, different opinions on how or if we should prepare, how much we should prepare, who should be involved and who should lead, or how much preparedness was really necessary. So today I'm going to talk about how to ignite a planning effort and maintain momentum. I will outline creating a vision, figuring out who your allies are, what resources you can use to get the conversation going, and how to take advantage of key moments to gain solid ground for emergency planning. So you'll understand some of the phrases I'm using. I just want to introduce the emergency management cycle and the phases of emergency management if you haven't seen these already. A lot of us would like to come in this nice green area, this mitigation area, you know, no, nothing's going on, we're mitigating our risks effectively, and we're fully prepared for the response. So mitigation is all those activities like your fire suppression, your monitoring storerooms, et cetera. Preparedness is all the activities you do to get ready for response. And then response is the event itself. And again, during response, this is not running in and taking art off the walls and running out with it over your head. This is human safety. This is life safety. This is incident stabilization. If you're having a fire, this is when the firefighters are in, and your role in collections planning is what comes next. How are we going to start that salvage effort? Recovery is everything that you do to return to normal operating procedures. So everything that the museum does, from working with insurance to object salvage to fundraising, getting the word out there. Okay. So first, we have to create a vision. What do we want our emergency program to be? We want to go for the Rolls Royce here, not the Datsun. So when you're instituting any sort of change, you have to provide a vision of success. And yet, emergency preparedness is sort of an un-goal. The best outcome is to have a highly trained team, resilient systems, and have no experience in using any of it. So creating a vision around constant readiness can be a challenge. But without a clear vision, emergency functions flounder, and they won't coordinate smoothly when put to the test. So the first step, we must build a vision that not only supports best practices, but offers benefits and connections among staff throughout the building for the program. So what are the components to your vision? I say create the big picture for everyone. Put it out there, go big or go home. Maybe your vision should include a budget line for ongoing emergency management activities, a trained team, an emergency plan that gets updated annually, established collection priorities, and a regular training schedule. Next, you have to define and you have to develop and refine that vision by identifying and creating partnerships with allies within your institution. So, education of decision makers and other colleagues to become allies is the next step to laying groundwork for beginning an emergency preparedness effort. This isn't something we do in a vacuum. When we do this in a vacuum, the plan is one-sided and doesn't reflect reality. That's not how we work together in institutions around preservation topics. So, who will our allies be? Emergency preparedness, even in the smallest of institutions, is not a one-person show. I'll get there. Let's start with supervisors. Who is your supervisor? Where do they sit in the organizational tree? Are they interested in emergency preparedness? Are they tolerant, at least, of it? Do they see this as part of your responsibility? If they haven't considered it, educate them about how risk management, which certainly is part of our responsibilities, and emergency preparedness are connected and are your responsibility. Consider how better emergency preparedness might support their work, depending on who you report to. Next, consider that sea of colleagues that can help you spread the message to support better emergency preparedness. Conservators, registrars, collections managers, technicians, IT staff, they are great partners for this. Curators, fire marshals, if you have fire marshals on your staff, or security staff that were ex-fire guys. Operations and facility staff, human resources, communications, and development staff can all make great partners in helping you share your message. If these professionals are not on your staff, if you're in a smaller institution, are you using consultants or service providers, other professional resources, or maybe local emergency managers to help you better refine your vision so you can communicate that clearly to the people in your institution? So, allies can make your project stronger by challenging assumptions, informing the project with their industry background, and using their connections to develop momentum around your idea. So, think about, in developing these partnerships, what projects between yourselves can you connect to emergency preparedness? Can you connect your effort to the audit? Are there? And I just saw that there's a session on audits, session 24, so about collection audits, so that's a good thing to connect to. Are there health and safety projects that maybe emergency preparedness can connect to? Construction, number one source of fires in museum is from construction projects. Is there an emergency plan for that work? Conservation and other projects may need an emergency preparedness component, and asking the right questions when those projects are being formed can help you further the message that you need an overall emergency management plan. All right. So, here's a visual. I just want to put in a small plug now for the American Institute for Conservation's Collection Care Network. We had a workshop back in Miami in May. It was called Influence for Impact, Leadership Strategies for Collection Care Professionals. And this slide is from Bob Norris. He was our workshop instructor. He just is a management consultant, and he happens to be the husband of Debbie Hess Norris, who's the head of the Wintertour University of Delaware Program in Art Conservation. So he knows a little bit about conservation and collections. And it was a great session. And I'm sorry, this is a little hard to see, but it's an equation that is about when you're leading change in an institution, what components you have to add together in order to overcome resistance. So it's sometimes nice to put a visual in front of yourself to like, So the components here are your vision, combine your vision and communicate your vision, and then add that with incentives and accountability. These are those projects that how can your work in emergency preparedness help their work in meeting their goals. And add skills, add additional skills, so you're improving everybody's professional development through training, extra training to meet this goal. And this is a natural for emergency preparedness because it does not happen without training. And that has to overcome resistance. A project that meets this model could be a collection risk assessment. This is the cultural property risk analysis model, and if some of you were in Chicago, you might have heard Rob Waller speak about this method. He's the author of this. Don't get bogged down in the equation right now. A cultural property risk analysis or collection assessment is one example of how to connect emergency preparedness with building relationships with potential allies in your institution. You have to work with your facilities administrators, your security staff, your IT staff in order to really determine specific risks for your collections and to what extent they can impact your collection. So this is a perfect model because not only are you building relationships with those people you're going to work with during an emergency response, but you're also helping mitigate risks that would cause you to have that response. So it's a perfect type of project to increase visibility for emergency preparedness. All right, so I just moved. I just bought a house, so we're gonna plant some seeds here. I'm like really using a lot of gardening analogies these days. So we have to plant some seeds right now, and we have to think about how a lot of times I know that we have a lot of experience going into our supervisors and saying I have this great idea and getting shot down. And you have to have resilience when you're trying to mount something of change. And so you have to plant those seeds, and we're going to talk about different ideas to help raise the awareness of the need for emergency preparedness in your institution. We need bright ideas. Okay. So in order to create an appealing message, we must assist others in not seeing the work ahead or the roadblocks or the relationships or systems that don't currently work well, or who gets the credit, but the benefits of the overall result centered on preserving access to collections. So how do we do that? We're going to start a talking campaign. You talk about it with everyone. It doesn't matter if it's not somebody you work with every day. Talk about what you do. and say, hey, you know, I'm really interested in about emergency preparedness here at this institution. What's your role? Or what do you think about that? Or do you get involved in that? And it doesn't matter who it is in your institution, be it someone from education, they have to worry about the school children there, whether it has to do with communications, who are going to have to talk to the media later after an emergency. Whoever, you know, you're in that elevator ride, make something of it. Serving as an advocate of emergency preparedness can often put you in the role of Stuart Little. But in an emergency, a message that was often greeted with irritation can become one of expertise. One thing you can do is start by putting a time frame on preparedness to create a challenge. When we don't, it seems like something we could put off. Pose questions that reveal preparedness needs for specific institutional goals. So think about things that are coming up that you really should be prepared for. Is there possible protest activity that might happen with an upcoming exhibition you're working on? Hurricane season, snow season, yeah, do you have snow loading risks for your building? Maybe not down here. But think about ways to put a timeline on something that we often push back. Maybe you should do a survey. Doing surveys, anonymous surveys of the staff, can give you a real good sense of people, you know, how old is their training and what do they think their responsibility is in an emergency. And it might surprise your administration if people feel like, that's not my responsibility, or my training it's been 5 or 10 years ago since I took that workshop. So they might realize that they're not as prepared as they thought they were. And you don't want to find that out when making phone calls after a fire. Look at the historical record. I'm from the Mid-Atlantic, so I'm talking about Hurricane Agnes here. That's 1972. And has your organization suffered a past emergency? Were there legendary man-made or natural disasters in the area where your institution is now? Hitting the archives can really serve you well. Hey, look, this might actually be a risk we need to think about and think about responding to. Is this a scare tactic? Not at all. It's information dissemination. These are the risks that we might have to respond to. And again, there's nothing wrong with the little scare tactics. So think about what emergencies may have a similar risk profile to your institution and what they've experienced. How can you connect that to your organization? Do you have a subway line going underneath your building, or is there construction nearby to your building, or is there construction on a new wing? This is the Cologne Archives, which collapsed in 2009. This is their collection in the middle of the rubble being salvaged at the bottom. Montreal Museum of Contemporary Art in 2012. Is the infrastructure in your city aging? Yes, there was an article in the New York Times just last week on how that is impacting human health. And this was one of those really heavy rainstorms came by, overwhelmed their infrastructure, and the water went into the basement of the museum. And do you store collections in the basement? Okay. Clandon Park fire this year, and are you in a historic house that doesn't have fire suppression? They did not have sprinklers, and this was the result. So the list goes on. With a little sleuthing, you can find an institution that might have a similar situation to yours and say, you know, I want to think about this situation. What would we do in this situation? On a more positive note, what are the great things that other institutions are doing? I really like this resource. This is Unexpected, Earthquake 2011, the Smithsonian put together just a bunch of short essays, even short communications, in which they talk about how various branches of the Smithsonian reacted to the earthquake in Mineral, Virginia. Library shelf collapses, fluid preserved collections falling out of their bunkers. They have a couple historic houses, so they talk about the impact of the earthquake on some 18th century houses. I think we need to do more of this. Let's put it out there. What are we doing to help preparedness in our field? Also, reaching out with a short survey to similar institutions or institutions in your area. Hey, what are you doing? What kind of plan do you have? Who's on the team? What are you doing? And use this effort to establish an informational exchange or to establish mutual aid agreements that you can help each other out when you have an emergency. And for me, it comes down to this. It comes down to reputation. What role does your organization play in your community, and what sort of preparedness would the community expect of your institution? If outreach is a hallmark of your institution, should your vision include fostering preparedness among other cultural institutions or even among your community? How should a preparedness program support your institution's reputation as a steward of collections locally, nationally, and internationally? Okay, we have to do some troubleshooting. Obviously, people might not receive our message with open arms. And I think there's often anxiety. No, but we don't want to experience this. So there's anxiety about having to deal with emergency preparedness. We can't know what we have to do until the emergency hits. You know, everything's different. Let's not waste time now planning. I don't think I hear this one as much anymore. I used to hear this one a lot, but then we had to deal with Irene, Sandy, climate change, different things. I think the more we make awareness of the challenges facing institutions, I think we hear this one less. We don't need make work. I think when we talk about reputation, and I think also when we talk about how much money we have to spend on recovery is always going to be more than preparedness. James Gilbert of Rapid Refile, it's now Polygon, again, salvage contractor, vacuum freeze-dry provider, said it's about $50,000 to just freeze-dry about 800 linear feet of books. And that's not much if you have a library flood. I have an exhibition to put on. What in that exhibition might involve the need for emergency preparedness or a response plan? There are ways to connect emergency preparedness, pretty much everything that's going on. Keep it moving. We might get it going. We might get a really good emergency plan going, but we have to keep it going, and having, you know, developing that momentum is critical. Create a standing meeting of the working group, or if there's no capacity for a working group at your institution, maybe having a small discussion group or an interest group. Just invite a bunch of people to lunch and say, hey, let's talk about emergency preparedness. Develop short, mid, and long-range planning goals and pick away at them. Create a training schedule of regular tabletop, full-scale, or coffee break exercises. A tabletop exercise, if you don't know, is you're just posed with a scenario. You sit around a table, and you're posed with a fire scenario or a flood scenario, and you just talk through the decision-making process. It reveals a lot about how your institution thinks and how they're going to think in an emergency, and it doesn't cost a thing. Coffee break exercises. He's the director of emergency preparedness for Con Ed, which is the power company in New Jersey, New York. He gets people coming in the door, and he poses scenarios when they come in the door. Hi, we have a fire. What's your role? You know, what's your next step? All those things can work on increasing your readiness and maintaining the momentum of your program. And then fight for the budget line. Doesn't matter how small a budget. It allows you to plan for the future and for the program to become a fixture. Harness the uncertainty and energy of your next emergency. That's a great time to ask for a budget. Okay. I want you to also think about connecting to the community. Get involved in professional organization outreach. A photo from Carolyn Riccardelli. She's a Met conservator, and she was on the AASLH heart team after Katrina. This was the Jackson Barracks in Mississippi down here, and she was going around doing assessment work. Get involved with Alliance for Response. Since Heritage Preservation has dissolved, Alliance for Response has fallen under the auspices of the Foundation of the American Institute for Conservation. There are 20-some chapters, and you can look them up in Google, and they all they have different things. They're at city level, state level, just depends where you are. Create mutual aid agreements with different institutions in your area, especially if you're a small institution or an isolated institution. reach out to local emergency management agencies. You can get great training by joining a community emergency response team. They train you in light salvage and rescue, first aid, incident command system, and you get a little bit more awareness of how the emergency managers are going to work. You can connect with them and share a little bit about your institution, what your needs will be. All right, so what's in it for me, you ask? Why not? Have I got your buy-in? I know we have a strong sense of professional commitment in this room, but you might be like, I have a job, I have a lot of roles that I'm doing right now, and you have to think about that. I found that working on a topic like this was really situational leadership, and it really presents you with an opportunity to display your ability to lead for the future. It creates ties with your operations and administration colleagues, which is also good for all the other preservation activities that might fall under your responsibility, and it hones your persuasion and management skills. So the process takes time, but each step is helping to develop resiliency at your institution. And from my experience, the months and years that it takes to have those conversations, to understand how the institution's going to function, to make those decisions, to encourage others to make those decisions, and to create a culture around emergency preparedness at your institution is as important as developing the plan itself. So with that, I want to make a little plug again for the Collection Care Network at AIC. Again, we're the home of preventive conservation and collection care. One resource we're doing is a historic house historic collections hazards guide. So if you have general history collections and you've got radioactive things and things made out of asbestos and things you're not sure about, it's something we're getting going on. If you have interest in that, let me know. We're looking for historic houses in the D.C. area for industrial hygienists to visit and identify risks that we can put in our project. And then also, AIC 2016, we're keeping with the French name that you have going here, will be in Montreal, and the subject is emergency preparedness. So I hope you're interested, and I hope you attend. All right, thank you.